You're listening to episode number 3 of The Optimal You. In this episode, I talk with licensed psychotherapist Greg Woodhill about porn addiction. Greg does an amazing job of educating me on this subject. I feel it's an important conversation and one that I hope you find really educational as well. A quick disclaimer, in this episode, we do talk about sex, pornography, and other adult-themed topics. I'm men's coach Andy Bates, and it's my mission to raise the consciousness of other men so that they may be better to themselves, each other, in relationship as leaders and fathers. In each podcast episode, we discuss strategy, learn from real-life examples, and get practical tips on how to be the optimal you. Greg Woodhill is a licensed psychotherapist in private practice who has spent thousands of hours directly helping porn addicts to recover from their addiction. He strongly believes that true psychological and emotional growth can only occur in a safe environment, which he provides for his clients through long-term therapeutic work. He holds a master's degree from the University of Santa Monica, is a certified sex addiction therapist, and spent 5 years working at the Center for Healthy Sex in Los Angeles. He is passionate about the topic of porn addiction and loves working with addicts to recover their sexual passion and create true intimacy in their lives. In this episode, we discuss why porn is so addictive, how porn taps into unresolved issues for the viewer without them even knowing it. Is there such a thing as casual porn use? Why porn is the kryptonite to intimacy? What to do if you or someone you know is questioning their relationship to pornography? Practical steps for dealing with a porn addiction, and much, much more. Without further ado, I give you my conversation with Greg Woodhill.
Thanks for being on the podcast.
It's my pleasure, Andy. Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to talk about sex addiction, porn addiction. You know, it still is, even though this is a huge industry in the U.S. and around the world, it's very underground. It's not talked about a lot. And in the work that I'm doing, I notice that a lot of guys, they want to move forward in their lives. They want to accomplish things. And something that comes up kind of often is this distraction that they have with pornography. So they may want to accomplish something, but they're finding large chunks of their day where they're not working towards their purpose or their goal or their achievements, and instead they're choosing to view pornography. Or talk to me a little bit about, if you will, what is porn addiction?
It's an important question, and it's a question that is getting asked quite a bit today, as it should be. I think there's a couple problems with the way that different people answer this question. So one of the problems is that, unlike myself, there are a lot of people out there, and I support these people, who have belief systems that say that pornography is bad, it's sinful, it's wrong, because it's against their religion, it's against their morality. Why I wouldn't want to take that point of view away from that particular person, that's not how I approach this entire topic. There are some people who, if you said, do I have a porn addiction? And they said, if you watch porn, then yes, you have a porn addiction. I disagree with that. So the thing that is so amazing, I think, about this topic is, like you said, it's coming up more and more in your conversations, and porn affects everybody. Everybody. It affects them, whether through their own use or the use of somebody they know or love or somebody that was in their family of origin. And one of the enormous things I think it's important to mention is that the discussion we were having about porn 15 or 20 years ago it's antiquated compared to what we're talking about today, because 15, 20 years ago, we didn't have high-speed computers in our pockets. And pornography has changed, it's morphed because of the needs of the user. So what used to be, when I was growing up, a VHS tape that was finite, you could watch it, you would have to interface with another human being in order to get it, you would have to stand in line and buy it, or you would rent it and you would have to pay for it. And then you would watch, there might be 3 or 4 or 5 sex scenes in a movie. If you wanted to watch it again, you would have to rewind it and go back and forth. Today, it's just very different because the needs of the user have changed. We are an entitled society. We're used to getting what we want when we want it. That's become true with pornography as well. So there are kids, not even kids, there are grown adults who, I love this term that I learned, it's called digital natives, meaning they've had high-speed internet since they were children, which was not my case, I'm older than that, that they've gotten pornography at their fingertips since before I think their brain was ready to handle it. So my answer to the question you're asking is that people find themselves with a relationship to pornography, and it doesn't have to be something that they have to jump through hoops to get anymore. It's very, very easy. So I think the number one thing, and you mentioned this a few minutes ago, is that we talk about it. I think that's one of the most important things, that we're talking to another human being about it, whether it's a friend or a family member or a coach or a therapist, because it's easier than ever before, and it's changed. So what used to be what people these days will call vanilla pornography, which is two people having sex on screen or three people having sex on screen, pornography has really morphed. It's become much more violent, much more overtly degrading. And yet again, I'm not putting a religious or a moral spin on this whatsoever. It's gotten so that what used to satisfy the needs of the end user doesn't work anymore. And they're saying we need something more degrading, more violent, more visceral, and they got it. So things that you wouldn't even know you could go your whole lifetime and not know how to find, you can find in a moment's notice just through Google or through any of these porn hubs where you type in a search term of something that you have or have not seen before but are curious about, and you get 1,000 different options of what to watch. So my long-winded answer here really is that some people are addicted and some people are not, and how do we draw the line between the two? And I think that's a big part of what we're talking about. So in what I've said, do you find any of this in the your own coaching clients or people you talk to that where their needs have changed, or that they're talking about something that they don't know if they're addicted or not?
Well, it's interesting that you talk about how just the simple obstacles that have been removed of having to interact with someone to get pornography, or just that it's always available. Yeah, I mean, that's coming up in all areas. I mean, even the news feed that is on our phone, or the Twitter that's constantly coming in. And this is what I would like to learn from you, is it's tapping into, or it's feeding us in some way. And that's why we're continually going for it.
Yep. Well, what you're describing, what you're describing is a function of the neurotransmitter dopamine, which is the feel-good chemical in the brain. It's what happens when we eat chocolate, when we pull the what used to be the lever on a slot machine over and over again, and then it hits, and maybe a jackpot or maybe something. Our brain lights up, and it feels good. What it tells us is focus here, look over here, and it has evolutionary purposes because it tells our brain something is different in our environment. You better focus on it, whether it's something to run from or something to run toward, like if it was food back in the day. But dopamine is the feel-good chemical. Cocaine hyperstimulates dopamine. Heroin hyperstimulates dopamine. And pornography hyperstimulates dopamine. So when we see something novel in our environment, it lights us up and it gives us tunnel vision. It's supposed to do this. The problem is with pornography, it hyperstimulates it. Now, you know what else does it? Exactly what you said. Twitter, email, texts, Candy Crush on our phone, these things that we are used to, these everyday things, but they really set these fireworks off on our brain where it says, look here, focus here, and it really on purpose gets us to hyper-focus on one thing, and that happens with pornography. So it does what it's supposed to be doing, which is really getting our attention, and it has a secondary function, or maybe primary when I think about it, is it takes us out of real life. And I think that a lot of people, you know, one of your missions is helping people find the optimal them, realizing where in their life they're living a mediocre life that is beneath what they want for themselves. And I think one of the things that pornography does beautifully, unfortunately, is it gives people a numbing, distracting, medicating place to go so that they can be in excitement for a little while instead of sitting here realizing, who am I? What am I doing in my life right now? They have something. So not only when they're watching porn, but then focusing on it, fantasizing about it, thinking about it, it takes them out of life. So that's, we could put that as a con, but it's also a pro for people because it feels really good. And that's one of the ways that addiction gets started. It takes people out of their feelings and their thoughts and everything that they don't want to be feeling in real life.
And then what you're telling me is that this dopamine fix, you start to get used to it at a certain level and then you need more and it needs to be a different kind of exciting. And then consumers want more aggressive things and porn, the porn industry is creating more aggressive things to feed that.
That's exactly what I'm saying. So there's two reasons. One is exactly, the first is, and I think we can talk about this a little later, is things that people want to watch because there's issues inside of themselves, anger, inadequacy, shame, issues with the same gender, issues with the opposite gender, that they're looking for, not realizing that they're trying to work these issues out in their life and therefore through porn. However, we can come back to that. What you just described, yes, exactly, is what gets people hooked because they get hooked on that dopamine blast. And in porn addiction, we've all heard of tolerance, right? Let's say for an alcoholic, it used to take 5 beers, then it took 9 beers, then it takes 10 beers and vodka. And then because the body adjusts, the brain adjusts, the physiological body adjusts. In pornography, tolerance is measured through variety, which is exactly how you just said it a moment ago. What used to get this dopamine spike in my brain, the neuroreceptors get bored with that. They say, I've seen this over and over again, and it's measured in variety. So I don't need more. It's not like I watched 1 hour of porn, now I need 4 hours of porn. That happens too. But what really happens is they need something different. So I need something different, a little more aggressive, a little more violent, and then even that becomes blunted because now I've seen this. So the porn addict and the porn addicted brain, it needs something different at all times, which is scary to a lot of people. I've worked with clients that literally I've heard different people say, usually men in their 20s say, I wish I could unsee some of the things I've seen, because they get to a point where if they had watched this, what might be an extremely violent video of pornography, if they had watched that on day one, they would have turned it off after 5 seconds and maybe, you know, been sick to their stomach. But after months or years of becoming accustomed, and their brain says, so what? I need something. I've talked to people who said eventually they were masturbating to things that weren't even sexual. It was just violence, literally. They weren't even watching pornography or watching things that were just like hard to come by, but videos where people were being hurt in real life. And these guys are traumatized. You know, they've been watching things that on day one they couldn't have watched, but eventually they become so desensitized that nothing gets them off anymore, so to speak. So it really gets kind of tragic, but it's what you said, that they seek out darker, more disturbing material. Not everybody, but I've talked to a lot of people where this does happen, that the brain basically says, so what? So what? You're just showing me the same type of thing over and over again. I need something different. And that's scary. And that is, you know, that is one of the markers of any addiction, is tolerance. I need more and more of the same thing in order to get the same high. Well, that's true in porn addiction for sure. And the unfortunate thing is that there's an unlimited amount of, it's literally infinite of what you can find. Since you and I have started this conversation, there's probably been 50 new clips and 1,000 new pictures added online. It's going to happen until we're done as a society, more and more and more, because people are consuming and need it.
It's intense.
It is intense. Yeah.
How pervasive is pornography addiction in our culture versus casual porn use? And is there even a differentiation in that?
There is a differentiation. It's a great question. It's a question a lot of people come in as clients and ask me on day one when they're seeking therapy, is, am I an addict? So casual use. Here's the biggest asterisk in this question is I don't think that how much that solely focusing on how much someone watches porn will be the differentiation between whether they watch it or whether they're an addict. So if someone says I watch it X times a week, that doesn't necessarily mean they are or are not an addict. Okay. The consequences, both internal and external, have a lot to do with whether or not I would say someone is an addict or not. I had a client who years ago came in thinking he was an addict, but he was barely watching porn at all. It was like once a month or once every 3 weeks. The problem was he had such shame about it and such religious convictions about it that he thought he was an addict. Now, he was not an addict, but that term gets thrown around because some people have such strong judgments against pornography that if there's a woman, let's say, and finds out her husband is watching pornography, she says, oh my gosh, he's a porn addict. So here's how we differentiate. One, like we talked about, there's tolerance. So I need more visceral, more, as I've said, more violent, more diminishing of another person type of pornography. Or even sometimes people are watching pornography outside of what they claim as their own sexual orientation. So I have known men who say I'm straight, and they say eventually they started watching bisexual or gay porn because it was different and crazy and made them feel certain, you know, things inside of themselves that vanilla porn wasn't working anymore. Then there's withdrawal. So just like with substance abuse or substance dependence, I should say, when porn users are using it enough that they need it and they stop, they do have withdrawal symptoms. They have anxiety. Sometimes they feel depression or shame or fear. A lot of the things they were masking in the first place, sometimes even physically to the point where they feel shaky, they feel really unnerved. So they're having emotional withdrawal symptoms. Another is that they're watching it a lot longer than they originally intended. I see this in a lot of porn addicts. They say, my kid had a baseball game. I knew I had 20 minutes to watch porn before I had to leave, and I ended up being 40 minutes late to the baseball game because I kept going and kept going. Same thing goes with any drug addiction or alcoholism. Then a persistent desire to stop, and I should say unsuccessful efforts to cut down or stop. Okay, I got to stop watching porn. I'm watching it too much. And then, you know, a year later, they think, wait a minute, I've tried to stop like 20 times and I keep going back to it. That's a great sign that there's addiction happening. And then another is that, like I mentioned with the kids' baseball game, that social, occupational, or recreational activities are reduced or given up because of the porn use. So a lot of these, yet again, they just go word for word into chemical addiction, but the same is true for any sort of process addiction, which pornography addiction is. So I'm not getting my schoolwork done, I'm late to work, I'm doing it at work, I'm not going out with my partner or whatever, you know, my kids, whatever the case may be. So they realize I'm losing time here because I'm watching so much porn. And then another is that how much time do you spend obsessing about it or obtaining it or actually acting out? Like, wow, I spent, you know, if I added it up, a person might say I spent 20 to 25 hours a week this week watching pornography. And then to me, what I think is the biggest indicator is it's ruining my life and I can't stop. That combination there. I'm having negative consequences. I know it's a problem and I still can't stop. So that's really taking two of the things I said before and combining them together. And those are the types of things I listen for when I talk to clients. Not, you know, I'm interested how long, how many times a week, where do you watch it? And many, many years ago, I talked to someone who watched pornography at work a lot, hours and hours and hours a week. And I said, are they monitoring your computer? And his answer was brilliant to everything we're talking about. He said, I actually have no idea. So he was watching 10, 15 hours of porn a week on his work computer and had no idea until I asked him that question, hadn't even thought about it because his mind was just about getting his fix. So that's a lot of the ways that we delineate between do you watch porn or do you have an addiction?
You said process addiction. Is that different from behavioral addiction?
Nope, same thing.
Okay.
Where a drug or alcohol is not involved. Yeah. So gambling, compulsive overeating, compulsive spending or debting, porn, sex, those type of things. Yeah.
It's fascinating because it's actually feeding the similar thing, right? The dopamine as a chemical would, like you said, with cocaine.
And the dopamine also, you know, as I was mentioning earlier, that porn has changed so much. And Dr. Patrick Carnes, he's who I call the godfather of the treatment of all sex addiction. Was it about maybe 40 years ago? He was on the scene saying this is it. Sex can be an addiction. It is an addiction. And he was mocked and laughed at and threatened and everything. And thank God for his work and his studies. And he calls internet pornography the crack cocaine of sex addiction. Mm-hmm. The reason he says that is because apparently, I must admit, I don't know this personally, but that crack cocaine can create addiction where there would be no template for addiction in the first place. So some people say I have an addictive personality, I came from a certain type of home, I have trauma that I'm trying to medicate through this addiction, whereas crack cocaine, you smoke it once and apparently it can become addicting immediately, which is what Dr. Carnes, and I agree, he says this about internet pornography, that it's like it's mainlining porn into the parts of your brain, and it's at a level that is for some people really hard to resist. But the dopamine thing, I think that the reason it is so addictive or so tantalizing is because there are things in most people who become addicted to anything that they are trying to medicate from real life.
Okay.
They are trying to get away from. I remember somebody that I love in my personal life, a family member, once said she is a crystal meth addict. And she said, I'll never forget the best feeling I ever had in my life was the first time I tried crystal meth. And I said, tell me, what was that feeling? What was it that was so amazing? And she said, nothing. I was really shocked to hear that. Nothing. That was the feeling. And it was the first time in her life that she had felt nothing. And she was hooked immediately, if that makes sense. Because she could block out the feelings, the thoughts, the self-perceptions, the pain, and suddenly she could just focus on nothing and she couldn't get enough of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so for her, a total disconnection was unique and blissful.
Yep, that's it. And I think the same thing goes for a lot of porn addicts, that it's, I have said before that porn addiction or overuse of porn is kryptonite to intimacy with a real life partner, that it's hyper stimulating the parts of the brain that want, it's like mainlining heroin, that it gets to the dopamine hyperactivity. And then I've heard over and over and over and over again, people getting then, let's say, quote unquote, into bed with a real life partner, whether it be someone new or whether it be somebody that they're married to or in a long-term partnership with, and their entire body says, like, it's like a record scratch for those of us who are old enough to know that reference. Like their body is just like, what is this? This is, they get so used to an isolated experience where they're in control. And they can skip and rewind and only watch the angles they like. They don't have to look at any body parts or any type of people. Everything is to their liking. They're in complete control of it. And it's fantasy. There's a wall. They're looking through a window into watching people. So eventually their brain gets so dependent on that that they get with a real person in bed and their whole body's like, well, what is this? Who cares? Where are the fireworks? Where's my sexual template that I've gotten used to? Now, this doesn't happen to everybody who watches porn, obviously, but those who really get into that addictive part, they do. They can have, I know a lot of men who have erectile dysfunction because they're watching so much porn. What we find, there have been, there are movements around this where people, especially men in their 20s, will stop watching pornography for between 30 and 90 days. Magically, they, you know, interact with human beings and find themselves, they can have erections again. They're, you know, they're suddenly not, because they're not disconnected as they were and reliant on this fantasy in order to get their body aroused anymore. So it's sad, you know, and it's the people who are really mired in any kind of porn addiction or compulsion, they have a lot of shame, Andy. They're not happy. They're not satisfied. they are, in fact, I'm talking about most of the people I've talked to. I've spent thousands of hours in the room with people who battle sex and porn addiction. They hate it, and they're very ashamed of themselves and feel very inadequate and don't want anyone to know, which makes the problem even worse. So they can't say to their partner, it's not you, it's not us, it's that I'm watching porn 2-3 times a day, and the person doesn't know that the partner of a porn addict feels like they are inadequate, feels like they are failing in some way because they can feel something missing, but in reality, the person's hooked on porn.
What you're saying is a lot of people aren't going to porn because they are dissatisfied with their physical intimate relationships or with a person. They're going to porn because there's something, an underlying issue for them that conscious or subconscious hasn't been worked out, and they work it out in this way that ends up destroying their life in a lot of ways.
Yes, when it's addiction, that's exactly what happens. Right. It becomes, they use it to get away from intimacy, and then using it keeps them in a constant loop where they're pushing them, where they don't want or have intimacy anymore. Mm. Now, this isn't true for the casual user. This isn't true for people who watch pornography because it turns them on. And one of the biggest things, some people might argue with this, and that's okay. I think we need to be talking about this. I'm glad you and I are talking about it right now. I think we as a whole, as a society, need to be talking about porn a lot more, destigmatizing it, as making fun of people who, you know, porn addict. It's like to throw that around like a shameful label takes away a lot of the empathy and compassion around it, just like we would say about somebody who's addicted to drugs or alcohol. We think that, and people who are addicted to porn, they think they're gross, they think they're bad, they think they're wrong. They don't want to tell other people that they're watching porn this much. And I think that's one of the biggest things. And I would say to anybody who wonders or worries that they're watching too much porn, step one is talk to somebody about it. If it's too difficult to talk to a friend or a family member or a romantic partner, then go talk to a professional about it, a coach like you, a therapist like me, another human being that you can sit in the room with. And that has been one of the biggest pleasures of working with this population for me, is on day one they come in and they have a visceral feeling like the person listening to them is going to flinch, or that they're going to be, you know, make faces in disgust because they're so shameful and so bad. And in reality, what they get is compassion and understanding, and someone who says, no problem, you know, I've heard this before. There's help, and let me tell you what to do, and you know, the things you can actually start doing right now to help you. And they leave feeling, it seems to me, like a 1,000 pounds have been taken off their chest because someone listened to them and cared about them and didn't run from the room screaming like they're some sick, disgusting, you know, person, which is how a lot of them feel walking in the door. And the other side of it is the exact opposite of what I just said, is that porn is incredibly normalized, so much so that I've heard a lot of people, they say, well, I don't know, millions of people, they just say, it's just what guys do. It's what guys do. So there's no problem with it. There's no shame about it. Now, I agree with taking the shame out of everything, really. But it might be a problem. Someone's masturbating to porn 2 or 3 times a day and they're not having sex with their partner. And then they say, well, it's just what guys do. Well, you know, I think that is the other side of the problem, where people say, oh, there is no problem because it's just what we do. Where I would say, but take a look at those things I said earlier. It's like, is your life suffering? Are you suffering? And are you, you know, are you living a far, far less optimal life and settling for the mediocrity in your life because you can't stop doing this? Then forget that this is just what guys do. If all guys shot heroin, that wouldn't, you know, and you were in a ditch shooting heroin and you lose your job, well, I wouldn't say, well, that's just what guys do. I'd say you have a problem. So I've seen miraculous changes from people who this was their life and their relationships, and they were suffering and they were lying, to really seeing them come out the other side of this and living again in a very different way, which is beautiful.
So step one is just, if you are wondering if you have a porn addiction or if your relationship to porn is healthy or not, step one is just talking about it with someone who is trained in some way to be non-judgmental and hold space for you to be able to express your thoughts and through that gain some perspective on,
yes,
on where you're at with your relationship to pornography.
Yes, I think that step alone changes the brain. Even if it's in a minuscule way, it's important because now you're in human contact. Now you're not in a relationship with you and your drug of choice, which is porn. You're actually talking to another person. And that is intimate. That is an intimate conversation to talk to somebody else about that. There's a website called SexHelp, SexHelp.com, mm-hmm, where there's an organization called ITAP that trains sex addiction therapists. And all of those people are also well-versed in pornography. And that's just basically, there's self-tests. There's something called the CAGE assessment, which is just a four-question assessment people ask themselves about porn. But that is if they're wanting to go talk to a professional, a therapist or a counselor confidentially. They can find somebody, hopefully, in their area. And if not, they can find somebody in their state that they could do telecommunication with, whether it's some sort of video conferencing or telephone. But to take some sort of online assessments. These days, this happens with everything. Someone could Google, am I a porn addict? Mm-hmm. And come up with, you know, immediately 10, 20, 100 different web pages are going to come forward where they can go ask themselves these self-assessments. But that's step one, is asking themselves the question and talking to another human being about it, which I think is monumental. Mm-hmm. I pat anybody on the back who has the balls and the courage to go talk to someone about this, because it's really personal. Talking about a sex life is very, very personal. Mm-hmm. And when you're masturbating to porn incessantly to a point where it's hurting your life, that's your sex life. That's become your sex life. So it's like that. It's something very important to talk to other people about, for sure.
How big of a difference is this in men versus women?
I can tell you who presents for treatment.
Okay.
Because that's the only data I have. It's the same thing with studies. We have no, the answer to your question is we have no clue.
Okay.
Because it would take surveying everybody and everybody being honest. What I see is men, all sexual orientations, that men are showing up en masse much more than women are. I've absolutely talked to women in my personal and professional life who are addicted to pornography, so I certainly don't mean to say that it's a one-gendered problem. It's not. However, what I see is, I'm going to make up a number off the top of my head, but 90 to 95% of the people professionally that I've spoken to are men coming to say, I'm watching way too much porn. Mm-hmm. I've talked to a ton of women who say, I watch porn now and then. Sure, I've talked to plenty of women who consider themselves addicted to pornography. But I see it as mostly a male problem, only because that's who's presenting for treatment. I may be totally wrong on that, but that's been what it's like for me.
This just has me sort of thinking off on another sort of tangent, is that how important physical touch and intimacy actually is for humans.
Yes.
And how our current state of being is so interfaced with computers and,
yep,
and things that aren't another person.
Yep.
And how, if we're not meeting that just basic need of physical touch, and then it's also we're living in a fantasy world of our pornography fantasies, and we're further being pulled away from physical intimacy and physical touch, how that is impacting us in many ways we may not even be aware of consciously.
I could not agree with you more. And did you see the movie Her, starring Joaquin Phoenix?
No, I know. Okay,
it's a great scene. I mean, this isn't what I'm about to say. Isn't even the crux of the plot. But in that movie, it's in the not too distant future, but in the future for sure. Everyone is walking around, and they all have earpieces, and they're all interfacing with their phones. Mm-hmm. It's more vocal than it is today, but it's like everybody. It's all they're doing, and then eventually they have artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So that then they have relationships with their computers at home that's coming through their phone. And I'm watching this, you know, there's like a subway scene where every single person is interfacing with their phone. And I'm thinking, like, that's where we are today. Mm-hmm. We really are, myself included. And we're talking about distractions and dopamine and human contact and the differences between them. And it's harder and harder to pick up the phone and call somebody. It's harder to not watch the seventh straight episode of Bloodline on Netflix, you know, and actually get outside and see people. You're right. We are born wired for connection, wired to see people's faces, their smiles, wired for hugs and affection and love, and just in the sense of being in another person's presence. And I think porn is part of a bigger issue, really, where I think we are much more disconnected than ever before. I won't, because I am older, I'm in my 40s, I will never join the argument that we are more connected through our devices than we used to be. I see people, you see them as well, mothers walking their babies on their phones, looking at their phones, interfacing with their phones. The baby has one view that's looking up at the mother's face, or caregiver, could be the father, could be a nanny, and the caregiver is looking at the phone. They're not getting what, and this is here, right, in this country, and people sitting, you know, a four-person family sitting at a table eating together. The two kids are on their iPads or their phones, and the two parents are talking around their own phones. This hurts to look at, in my opinion, and that is a part of in what I hear and what I see in my office, or people are suffering from. Because imagine you're a heroin addict and you were literally walking around 100% of the time with a backpack full of heroin, that you just say, I'm not going to do heroin, even though you know it's literally on your back. That's how porn addicts have to live these days with their phones. It's a joke. I've said sometimes, especially young guys, like, can you go get a flip phone? Can you not have, you know, it's a laughable question. Of course, I do everything through my phone. I'm not going to get rid of my phone, but that's the gateway to their drug of choice. So one of the things, you know, if it works for you, I'd love to talk about some of the things I suggest to people to do if they realize that they do have a problem. I've already said the first, which is to go talk to somebody about it.
Yes, I want to know step two.
Yeah, step two is... Let me give you about three step twos.
Okay.
So, because I think they're all pretty equal. Well, one of the biggest things I say, and this is a hard, hard thing that I ask people to do. It's a very courageous thing to do, which is to find a fellowship. Because if someone has assessed and decided they do have an addiction to pornography, or sometimes pornography is part of the whole in some kind of a bigger sex addiction, So is to go to a 12-step meeting.
Okay.
So there are many different 12-step meetings for people who are in the sex addiction category. One of the problems porn addicts have is they say, I don't want to go to a sex addict meeting because I'm a porn addict. And for better or for worse, in this day and age, the vernacular ties all of that together. So there is a fellowship called Sex Addicts Anonymous, SAA. Of course, they have a website, and they're in a couple years ago, I checked in Los Angeles, they had 96 meetings a week in person in Los Angeles, which I think is absolutely astonishing and fantastic. There might be more today for all I know. Mm-hmm. There are other fellowships, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, SLAA. There's Sexaholics Anonymous, SA. There's also one, a newer fellowship called SPAA, Sex and Porn Addicts Anonymous. All of these fellowships are different from one another. A couple of them are religious based, so lust becomes the villain, the thing that they are fighting against. More power to you. It's like if people are devout Christians or Christians at all or Catholics, sometimes Sexaholics Anonymous is the fellowship they choose because it really looks at a lot of these things as sin. However, Sex Addicts Anonymous is an enormous fellowship, SAA, where each individual addict says what their drug is and asks that they get help on staying away from that drug. So they don't walk in the room and then some elder says, let me tell you what you need to stop doing. They, along with another human being, they come up with, and some people, it's porn. That's it. I can't watch porn. I don't have problems with escorts, prostitutes. I don't have problems with cheating. I don't have problems with frauderism or exhibitionism, it's just pornography. And then they get help not watching pornography from their brothers in the program. So go to a 12-step meeting, listen to one online. These days they have telephone meetings, they have internet meetings, but going, it's the same thing you said earlier, being in front of people, telling your 3-minute pitch, seeing people nod, seeing people laugh because they have lived the same things you're talking about, hearing other people talk about their lives. Suddenly there's an us instead of a me behind closed doors. Suddenly they feel like they're part of a whole. They feel, I'll never forget, many years ago a client came in. I told him, go to an SAA meeting. He came back the next week and said, I've never felt less ashamed of myself as I do now that I've been to that meeting. Because he was surrounded by people where he thought, I like these guys. These people seem pretty cool. And I can resonate with all the things they're saying. And they're just like me. So maybe I'm not such a shameful monster, these horrible names we call ourselves. So they basically just gave oxygen to it. And they were amongst other people, brothers and sisters who share the same addiction. Another one is reading. There are several books that people can get. The Bible, as I call it, of sex addiction is written by the aforementioned Dr. Patrick Carnes. It's called Out of the Shadows. It's been around for many decades. They have a follow-up book called In the Shadows of the Net. That's for people who find themselves just addicted to pornography. Now, it's a dated book. It still refers to the sound of the modem, which we haven't heard in a long, long time. But it is about, you know, what happens in the wiring of the brain. There's a married couple called the Maltz, M-A-L-T-Z. They wrote a book called The Porn Trap. And they give a lot of explanation about what happens in the brain and a lot. Now, some people have said that it does feel like it's written from a religious skew. I saw that in some of it. I saw that it wasn't that way. They give a lot of anecdotal things from clients. And I think that is important too. A man named Rob Weiss and Jennifer Schneider wrote a book called Untangling the Web. All of these books are on the same topic, but they're all different from one another. So this kind of psychoeducation, I think, is really important for people to really start understanding what they're going through. One of the other things I suggest, and this sucks for a lot of people, I understand that, but is to get some sort of filtering or blocking software on their phones and on their laptop or computer. There's two types of software, and some of them overlap. Some of those are blocking, so it won't let you go on certain types of sites. It'll block anything sex-related. The problem is it sometimes blocks things that are not, like you can't go to YouTube. However, it will block things. But then there's others that's accountability software, which means that it will send like a daily report to somebody.
Okay.
That could be the person's partner. It could be their sponsor or somebody if they're working a 12-step program that they say, hey, so that they know someone else is watching, not someone who wants to kill them if they do it, but somebody who supports them. And they know, okay, I could go do this right now, but my sponsor's going to know. Therefore, it gives them pause and they think twice about it. So those are some of the things I say, get, you know, human contact, educating yourself about it, and then putting a barrier in between you and your drug of choice, which is these software things. It can help. In this day and age, if you're savvy, you can get around any filter. You can go buy a new computer. However, it gives that person pause. It gives them a moment to reflect and decide, do I really want to do this? But talking to other people, that is the biggest thing, getting human contact around it. Is what I say more than anything. There's two movies, by the way, that I would throw out there if people are ever interested. Both of them have some sort of, especially the first one, has some what we would call triggering imagery. If people are in recovery for porn addiction, however, the first is called Shame, and it's starring Michael Fassbender. It's about sex addiction, but porn addiction is part of it. And you see in that movie the escalation we were talking about. The escalation of the addiction, the tolerance to where he needs more and more, more visceral, more scary, more this or that. And the other movie is called Thanks for Sharing, or Thank You for Sharing. I don't know which, starring Mark Ruffalo and Gwyneth Paltrow. And it's about sex addiction, and they definitely deal with porn addicts. And they show what it's like to be in a relationship with somebody who is in recovery for sex addiction. I think that movie was done really, really well. Okay. So those are things that people can just watch and say, wow, what am I learning from this, and do I see myself in this?
Beautiful.
Heavy topic, isn't it?
Well, I'm finding that it's heavy, but I'm also finding that I'm fascinated, and these are things that aren't in my everyday discussions, and so I don't know. I'm feeling good that I'm adding some things to the tool belt. If I'm noticing something, or someone, a friend, or someone's telling me something, these are all really great things to have in that tool belt to be able to take that discussion a little bit further. The biggest thing is just what you said, destigmatizing it, getting any sort of shame or judgment out of it, and just dealing with it.
Yeah. Talking about it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Talking about it.
And talking about it can, as long as you're choosing the people you talk to about it wisely, can be a very de-shaming experience for people. Mm-hmm. I find it to be very hopeful, and I'm scared. I'm scared for the generation who have had porn in their pockets. If I was 8 years old with high-speed internet, you better believe I would have been Googling naked women or boobs or sex or whatever. Of course, why wouldn't we? We're curious. And I thank God, so to speak, that type of thing wasn't available. You know, if we caught a topless woman on Cinemax or on HBO when we were kids, that was like a dopamine field day. Or I remember Van Halen's video Hot for Teacher was like pornography to me when I was like 9 years old. My brain could handle that. I could handle a woman in a bikini. You know, it was objectification, no question, but I could handle it. But what these kids and teenagers are looking at now, it's way beyond what their brain is ready for. And I feel a lot of compassion, and we'll see. We'll see as time goes on how this conversation evolves. But it can be very hopeful, because you've said it many times, so have I, that it's the human connection, in my opinion, that is the antithesis of porn addiction, and it's intimacy, and it can be. And I want to say one thing too, that I said this about a 30 or 90 day break. I guess the one thing I completely missed here to say that is the number one first step to take is try to stop watching porn.
Sure.
I mean, that, I think it's so obvious, I forget to say it sometimes, but if somebody feels like they're compulsive or that they're addicted to pornography, try to stop. That's number one. And then go talk to somebody about it.
Okay.
Just, and some people find that they can, no problem. Others find that 5 hours later they're watching it again, or the next day. And if we can't stop doing something that isn't serving us and that's in fact hurting us, there's a problem. Mm-hmm. So so the brain can and absolutely has been, in so many cases that I've seen, rewired when people can stay away from it and they find their lives changing, they find themselves opening up to intimacy and being able to perform sexually, not having to fantasize when they're in bed with somebody about porn, which is very normal. They're able to ejaculate, they're able to get erections. These are for men, of course. So the brain and body can really heal itself. It wants to be normal, but we have to give it the right, all the right stimuli in order to do that.
What was the term that you gave early in the conversation for someone that's grown up in a generation that's only had high speed internet?
What was digital it? Native?
A digital native.
Yeah, what? It's become, yeah, and people like you and I are considered digital immigrants.
Okay.
Which is accurate. We came into it in our adult lives. You were going to ask?
What's the conversation look like for parents of a digital native talking about healthy relationships to this digital world of sex and porn?
Yeah. I'm not a parent, mm-hmm. but the answer to that question, as I understand it and as I've seen it, is normalizing the curiosity, normalizing the desire, keeping anything shaming, any language, any facial expression, to just really flood your child, no matter what age, with love and compassion and understanding. Mm-hmm. There's nothing sick or bad or wrong about what they're doing. It's very human to want to find these things. So for parents to basically to keep the conversation open every child and teenager's phone and a computer should be either filtered or monitored or both. A parent should know what the kid is searching for and what they're watching, and to talk to them about it so that the kid knows, oh, I get it. I'm not bad. I'm not wrong because I saw something pornographic, but that the parent can say, just like what you and I are talking about, it can really hurt you to look at this now. When you're older, it'll be different, but you know, it's okay that you look, there's no problem, but you have to trust us when, you know, you're not being punished, but you have to trust us when we tell you that this is really bad for your brain and we want you to be, you know, happy and successful, and these are things that are just going to hurt you. So until you're older, you know, we have to just say, please don't look for this stuff, and we want to join you. So, but you can come talk to us about it. Are you confused? Are you angry? Are you whatever? It's okay. So it's okay, in my opinion, is the biggest underlying message to the kid. Not it's okay to look at whatever you want, but it's okay that you want to. Mm-hmm. And if you have questions, let's talk about it. You know, I know it's kind of be dorky to come talk to your parents, or it's uncomfortable, but we're here for you. And like I said earlier about filters, if they want to look at porn, they're going to look at porn. They're going to have a friend at a house that has an unfiltered laptop or a phone, but you can just keep the conversation going. I had parents who let me know that I could come talk to them about drugs or alcohol, or if I came home and I had been drinking, I could tell them, yeah, I had some drinks tonight. So I told them. It was. I understood. I wasn't going to get in trouble for saying that I drank. I told them because I knew that it was that they were going to want. They cared about my safety, you know. So I did it, and I think the same thing is true for this. That if parents can talk to their kids openly and lovingly, and if you're upset or angry about it, you process that with other adults, not with your kids. Mm-hmm. You know, that you right. take care of that, but just love them and normalize it.
Okay, it's just creating a boundary, but you're yes. right. Not total free reign on the yeah. the internet or anything, but a boundary, and then also that it's yes, it's normal that you'd want to explore past that boundary, but then also yep. for parents to realize, so I think what you're saying is there is actually a neurological reason to not for kids not to see this imagery in a yes. developmental stage. It's not just that. Oh, because it culturally it's wrong. It's actually right. You could damage their brain if they're yes. exposed to these things.
You're right on. They're in a very malleable time for the brain in development. Teenagers, I'm talking about, but and kids as well. That if the first images I'm seeing are overwhelming to my brain, then sex that is disconnected, that is violent, that is degrading, and that has nothing to do with feelings or warmth. I'm not saying you have to make love every time. Mm-hmm. You know, have crazy sex, whatever, you know, works for people. I'm in favor of, as long as it's consensual and everybody's of age. And that's what, you know, to kids, what they're seeing for the first time over and over and over again, times a million, is something that can damage their arousal template or their expectations about what a man is, what a woman is, what sex is, what pleasure is. They're getting messages that are simply wrong and that are teaching them at a time where their brain is soaking it up much more than adults. They're trying to figure out what and the expectations. I only know this anecdotally through stories I've read and clients I've talked to. Is that teenage boys and girls are acting out porn with each other because they don't know any better. Like you said, it's a developmental stage that can be very harmful when they're not talking about it with other people.
Mm. Okay. So pre-step one is, if you're a parent, have some healthy conversations with your create awareness, get curious about what's going on today and yes. you know, be bold enough to have a potentially uncomfortable conversation with your kids.
Yes. Yes. And my side note is I would even, as a parent, I would even call that out to the kid. Look, this is uncomfortable. Yeah. It's okay. You don't want to talk to your parents about this. We get it.
When we started, I jumped right into it. I was excited, but tell me a little bit about you. You know, how did you get into, who are you? Where are you from? How'd you get into this biz?
Well, I moved to our fine city of Los Angeles to become a famous actor. And spoiler alert, it didn't happen. And so in figuring out next careers, I did go into a different career after acting that wasn't as fulfilling. However, then people around me in my personal life and family members started saying, why don't you just go back and get your master's in therapy? It's what you do. It's who you are. I mean, people come to you to talk, you share, you do your own self-help and healing. You know, you're a counselor. Go do this professionally. And so despite thinking I was too old, I was, you know, 32 at the time, I eventually did that and realized that this is what I'm here to do on this planet. I love my career, love being a therapist. And in seeing pornography and how it is so pervasive in all of the men's lives that I've known from, you know, high school through college all the way through adult life, that I thought, you know what, I'm realizing that porn has hooks. It has hooks in the brain for some people, that it's something that it replaces intimacy or shields someone from intimacy. And I started reading more about it and getting more interested, and I went and took a training as an intern about sex addiction and porn addiction, and I got hooked just in hearing about what it means to treat this and what it's like to work with sex addicts and porn addicts. And the more I read and the more I got into studying it, the more excited I became about it. So eventually I got certified as a sex addiction therapist, reading more and more about porn, treating it. And the way we learn about it is treating it. We could read 1,000 books, but you have to be in the room with sex addicts, with porn addicts, listening to their stories, listening, finding out what works and what doesn't work. I don't know any of that from reading books. They're human beings who have suffered through the process and have come out, many of them on the other side, a lot more happy. So that is how in my own personal life and the people around me and then the clients that I've treated, like, I just get more and more passionate about this topic of porn addiction. And it's so behind closed doors. And I envision, although there's, of course, news stories pop up on TV and on the internet about porn and this study or that study, there are different sides of this, what has unfortunately become an argument. There are people who say there's no such thing as porn addiction. There can't possibly be porn addiction or sex addiction. It's fake. And those who treat it are puritanical and they're trying to force their views on you and they're scheming to rob you of your money. And it really is an unfortunate debate, because I'd say if you don't believe in porn addiction, go see somebody who doesn't believe in porn addiction. If you know you're a porn addict, come see somebody who treats porn addiction, and let's help people who need help. Because I see people showing up and with all of the diagnostic criteria for any addiction, like we were talking about earlier, their lives are in shambles. Their inner life is in shambles as well. And I love seeing them, and they treat it like an addiction, and they get support like an addiction, and they stop. You know, they stop using their drug of choice. So working with porn addicts has just gotten me more and more excited to work with porn addicts. So it's what I do, and it's what I write about and speak about, and I envision a world where it's really much more part of the pop culture conversation.
It's important. This That's was a little an important bit of talk.
Yes, I think so too. I agree. I appreciate what you dealing with this with the clients that you work with, and it is unfortunately a very emasculating thing that happens where, without really realizing it, men are, this is a really strong word to use, but in certain ways, emotionally and physically, they're castrating themselves. Not literally, of course, but they're really taking so much of their life force away without realizing it, mm-hmm. and handicapping their intimacy. If they say I masturbate to porn 2-3 times a day, so I'm a super sexual guy. Mm-hmm. Of course, when I get into bed with a person that I'm attracted to, it's going to be, you know, through the roof. It's going to be great. I'm always sexual. And they find themselves completely non-sexual when they're in the room. Mm-hmm. And I would say, of course, you're training your brain mm-hmm. to be turned on when you're by yourself and fantasizing and voyeuring on something that you're not involved with. You're not in the room with another human being, and the brain knows the difference. Mm-hmm. So it's scary.
I think you're right. I mean, I see that. It's so easy to get turned on with the things that are on our computer and on our devices. But the real magic comes the real beauty in this life is when you actually turn that around and you find you get turned on by the real world, the things that are yes. around you, the people that are in your life, because the richness that you will receive from those interactions and those types of things blows anything away that you'll ever see on your computer.
No question. And two things come to my mind before we finish, which is one, porn can be educational. I would say it is, to a point. What body parts look like naked? That's something we don't know when we're young, when we're kids. It's like what the gender that we want to have sex with or that we have crushes on, like, what does this look like? How does this work? What is sex? I think we can learn things that are very accurate in porn, and we can learn things that are unbelievably inaccurate in porn, like that every woman gets turned on by being degraded and humiliated. I mean, that isn't true. What goes where? Sure, that's something to look at. You know, what does oral sex look like? So porn, of course, it's not evil. It's not bad, in my opinion. It can be educational at first and to a point. The other thing is that there's an author, David Deida. His last name is spelled D-E-I-D-A. He wrote many books, and one of them is called The Way of the Superior Man. And what he talks about in that is that men have this compulsion or desire to do something about their arousal, by which he means to masturbate and ejaculate. We got to do something about it, do something about it, do something about it. And he says we get addicted to ejaculation. Mm-hmm. That I walk down the street, I see a woman I'm attracted to, and my brain and my whole body as an organism says, I have to do something about that. And what he says, it's a great book, I don't agree with everything in it, but it talks about the masculine versus feminine polarities, is that that drains us of our masculine life force if we're compulsively ejaculating all of that life energy out. So one of the things he says is, and I think in this case he's talking about heterosexual men. You're out and about in the world. This could go for I should say, any sexual orientation. You see someone, in this case, let's say you see a woman who you're very sexually attracted to. He says, breathe in that energy. You're feeling what the feminine does to you. Breathe it in. Imagine it going down through your toes. Breathe it all the way back up through the top of your head. Feel it. And enjoy it, and then go on with your day. Wow, look at how the feminine energy affects me, is what he says. Mm-hmm. This is amazing. I feel alive. I feel visceral. I feel vital. And now I'm going to go on, and I'm going to use that energy to inform my life, to bring out my masculinity, as opposed to I have to go jerk off thinking about that woman, which in what he says, it expels and basically just vomits or sneezes out, as he says it, all of that energy. So there's nothing bad or wrong about looking around and being attracted to people or wanting to have sex with people we see. The question is, do we have to compulsively do something about it, as he says? And I think he's got a good point. He's not saying masturbation is wrong or that ejaculation is wrong. He's just saying, do we feel like we always have to evacuate it from our body instead of realizing, like, ooh, this is good. I'm going to hold on to this and let it fuel me into being, you know, the optimal masculine version of myself.
Mm-hmm. Getting curious about what is that excited feeling that I have, and can I harness it instead of what is this exciting feel that I have? I got to get rid of it.
Yep.
Is important and wonderful, and is something that I talk to a lot of people about, and for myself, am new at practicing. Mm-hmm. Doing that with all of my feelings and emotions, you know, getting yes. curious, what is this fear and why do I have to get rid of it? Or, you know, is this the same thing as being excited? Bringing a curiosity to it and finding the power in it, you know,
because
it reminds me of something you said earlier. If you're shutting off this part of you, you're shutting off all of you.
Right. That's a great point, what you're saying. And one of the things when people are a little bit further along in treatment, what I ask them is two different questions. One is, what is it like to sit with? Even if you're a porn addict and you say, I'm going to masturbate to porn. Okay, no problem. But before you do, sit there. and ask yourself, what am I feeling right now? A lot of the things you just mentioned, I think, are going to be part of it. I'm anxious, I'm afraid, I'm ashamed. And like you said, do I even know the difference between those things? The other that I say to a lot of anybody struggling with any sex addiction is, it's a magical question because it's not possible. But if we could surgically remove the arousal in this moment, what would you be feeling? And it, and people come up with great answers to that. Okay, if I wasn't just like jonesing for porn right now, if we could take that out of the brain magically, I'd be feeling afraid. I'd be feeling ashamed. I'd be feeling happy, you know, joyful, celebrate, whatever the thing. So it's like you were saying, there's intimacy between a person's head and their own body and their heart. So what am I masking by this addiction? Why am I doing this? And some of the times, if the person's still going to do it, fine, do it. But just be aware of what you're feeling. And like, you know, you're listening to the feeling. So you're starting to develop an understanding of, why am I doing this in the first place? What am I trying to get away from? Even if it's good feelings.
Anything else you wanted to talk about?
As verbose as I am, I think we've covered just about everything there is to talk about on this topic for now.
You're great at this. Yeah, really, I mean, covered a lot in a very thoughtful and proactive way. Lots of great practical tips, which I think is helpful to not just wax poetic, but to actually say, if you're wondering, if you have questions, do this. That goes a long way for people.
Yeah.
Where can people connect with you?
My website is my name, gregwoodhill.com. GREGWOODHILL.com. There is a section, a tab on porn addiction, where people can ask themselves some questions. They can read a little bit about it. I have some training videos that I did and some interviews that are on my website that people can, for clinicians, for example, if somebody is a coach or a therapist and they're wondering, how do I work with it? They can go to my website under media, I believe, and I have an hour-long training I did about how to treat porn addiction. And all of my contact information is on there. They can email me or they can call me. And even if it's just for a consultation, this, you know, this is where I am, this is where I live, and I can't come into therapy, but what can I do? Of course, like a lot of people, I'm always happy to talk to people. So that's where to find me.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really grateful for you for getting this out, talking about it, spending some time with me.
Thanks, Andy, and I'm so grateful for you. Thank you for asking the questions and for making this part of your mission. It's been really lovely to talk to you.
If you like this podcast, please subscribe. There are many more great ones on the way. And if you're ready to tap into your own potential and be the optimal you, contact me today by going to theoptimalyou.com.